KPLO FM Portland, Tattoo People.
I'm Lena Aliolor.
This is Scott Fink.
This is Linda Olsen-Austin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nave.
I'm Robert Barncourt.
Volunteer-run, community-powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Mayor Sam Adams gives his State of the City address.
A federal appeals court okays the killing of sea lions at the Bonneville Dam.
And the U.S. National Guard announces plans to leave New Orleans.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 27th, 2009. I'm Jamie Hine.
And I'm Liam Delta. Portland Mayor Sam Adams gave his State of the City address to the Portland City Club today. In the talk, he laid out a 5-point economic development strategy to help save the city from the worst effects of the recession. Here's the mayor.
We will have inclusive prosperity. We will ensure that our workforce development efforts match our targeted industries so that we can be sure our city's graduates are ready to fill the jobs and build the companies that drive our city's green leadership. And we will work to ensure that minorities and women workers and business owners get their fair share for the first time of the opportunities they have so long sought for and deserve. I signed off on the largest incentive package for any company in the history of this city to land the opportunity to get Vestas here, $250 million in private investment that it will leverage and up to 850 jobs and will pump in the kind of adrenaline that our green economic development needs more than ever. And I want to thank again the Portland Development Commission for their great work on this project. Second, the federal economic stimulus. And I know I speak for the council when I say this, that we are so grateful for the federal economic stimulus package. We are so incredibly grateful. But it does present some challenges. We expect the federal funding to come in upwards of 67 different spigots of funding. It's coming with, as far as we know, with mostly the usual red tape and mandates and a couple of new ones. You have to buy USA, which is great, if we can find all the products, and you have to turn dirt in days. It makes for bizarre and strange list making sometimes. But in the spirit, in the best Portland spirit and local spirit of cooperation, over 45 agencies have organized around the table to put this economic stimulus to work fast and to not only get people jobs, but to also have the companion training and education so that after 2 years of economic stimulus jobs, they are actually skilled up to continue to work at a higher level. And third, we're already making headway in establishing Portland's International Center of Excellence. There are over 100 centers of excellence, believe it or not, for sustainability in the United States. The partnership with Governor Ted Kulongowski and the Oregon University System, we're pleased to announce that we have agreed on building the Oregon Sustainability Center and the future home of the Portland plus Oregon Sustainability Institute. And fourth, I'm pleased to announce today that we've recruited a hands-on expert in the for-profit sustainability industry. I'd like to introduce you to Steve Strauss. I'm recommending Steve to be the next candidate for the Portland Development Commission. And he brings experience and leadership in green building, and it'll be perfect. Steve is president of Glumac, a building services engineering firm with offices in Seattle, Portland, Sacramento, San Francisco, Silicon Valley, Los Angeles, Irving, and Las Vegas. Good luck. Steve leads a firm where all principals and associate principals are LEED accredited professionals and are focused on and making a real impact on conserving our natural resources for projects big and small. And while we move forward on our economic development action plan, we're also finding ways to make green and sustainable projects easier to build in this city.
That was Portland Mayor Sam Adams speaking today at the City Club on his economic plan for the city.
Saturday is Immigration Day here in Oregon. In the capital city, Salem, immigrants will be coming together to learn their rights and responsibilities in the U.S. and what they can do to improve chances for immigration reform. The recent Oregon law prohibiting undocumented workers from getting driver's licenses has been a hardship for some. The continued immigration and customs enforcement raids of employers also have heightened fears. KABU's Julie Derrick has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
There will be a somber note to Saturday's Immigrant Action Day in Salem. This week in Bellingham, Washington, 28 people were arrested in a federal immigration raid. The handcuffs and ankle chains and ICE agents in riot gear are representative of what immigrants' rights groups say is overkill for workers who are neither criminals nor terrorists. Francisco Lopez of the Oregon group CAUSA says the raid underscores the need for comprehensive immigration reform.
All the political rhetoric, all the anger, all the hate will not resolve the problem. The problem is that we have a labor force in this country that is contributing to the economy that needs to be legalized. That's the solution.
Lopez says Immigrant Action Day is a chance for people to learn their rights and responsibilities and also to discuss problems unique to Oregon, including the restrictions on getting a driver's license passed by last year's legislature. The event takes place at Chemeketa Community College in Salem on Saturday from 10 to 3. Francisco Lopez of the Oregon group CAUSA says 120,000 immigrants are part of the fabric of every Oregon community, and they're not stealing jobs from anyone.
This is not the time to look for the scapegoat of this economic crisis among the poorest of the poor in our state. We know who is responsible for this crisis, and they have a private jet, and they work on Wall Street.
ICE says its goal is to round up dangerous fugitives. But 5,300 of the 7,300 people detained in the Northwest last year had no criminal background, according to a study by Yale Law School's Migration Policy Institute. For KABU News, I'm Julie Derrick.
A federal appeals court has refused to block plans to start killing sea lions at Bonneville Dam. The NOAA Fisheries Service has been concerned about the sea lions because they eat endangered salmon. The ruling gave Oregon, Washington, and Idaho permission to trap the sea lions and kill up to 85 a year if they can't house them in zoos. The Humane Society of the United States filed a lawsuit to stop the killings, but lost the case. Last month, it also lost an appeal, but asked for a stay of the judge's ruling. Today, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals refused to issue the stay. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is ready to start trapping sea lions at Bonneville Monday.
In Washington State, Teamsters have announced new complaints against Oak Harbor Freight Lines. Workers returned to work earlier this month after going on strike last September. But now they say that the company wants to cut returning workers' benefits and suspend union activists. Now, the Teamsters are reporting that Oak Harbor Freight is going to suspend 13 union employees and may terminate more workers because of union activities. Health care and retirement benefits may also be eliminated. The union says that Oak Harbor's actions may incite a new strike.
This week in Washington, D.C., the U.S. Supreme Court heard a controversial case that may determine the future of over 1 million acres of land in Hawaii. Governor Linda Lingle has asked the court to rule on the state's right to sell what are called ceded lands. Those are crown and government lands of the Hawaiian Kingdom. In Hawaii, this case is seen as more than a matter of land title. To Native Hawaiians, it's an attempt to erase their history as a nation state and their rights to self-determination. FSRN's Ann Kiala Kelly tells us more.
Atina Wong, teaching a mele to her students from Halau Lokahi Charter School. They're taking part in a 12-hour vigil being held this week at the state capitol in downtown Honolulu in protest of a U.S. Supreme Court hearing. Ricky Kamai is one of the students from Halau Lokahi.
We come over here to make sure that Linda Lingle doesn't sell the stolen lands, which doesn't belong to her at all.
Governor Linda Lingle and Attorney General Mark Bennett are asking the Supreme Court to rule on the state's right to sell the so-called ceded lands of Hawaii. These lands are the crown and government land of the Hawaiian Kingdom, seized by the United States in 1898 after the U.S. backed overthrow of 1893. Since then, the government has attempted to privatize this land, but these attempts have often met with lawsuits filed on behalf of Hawaiians. So far, the lawsuits have stopped some of the large-scale real estate developments that dominate the landscape of Hawaii.
Linda Lingle does not represent the interests of the general public. She represents the interests of big business here.
Dean Saranelio, a non-Hawaiian resident, is an educator and activist who calls himself an Asian settler in solidarity with Hawaiians. His dissertation through the University of Michigan focuses on the fraudulence of statehood.
Hawaii is often imagined as the 50th state, and U.S. domestic law takes precedent, but what that doesn't acknowledge are the international implications to Hawaii, which is that Hawaii was on the list of non-self-governing territories in 1946, and nations such as Russia and China have both been asking the United States when they're going to place Hawaii back on that list. Hawaii was illegally annexed in 1898 by joint resolution, which has no bearing on in international law.
Others agree, including Richard Pomai Kaioka Lani Kini, a longtime Hawaiian activist and independence advocate.
Governor Lingle is trying to have the Supreme Court say that the state of Hawaii has the right to sell the land in fee simple, that the native Hawaiian people have no rightful claim to the lands. To me, there is no way that the United States Supreme Court can rule in favor of the state of Hawaii if they do the research and history.
Kinney, Saranelio, and an ever-increasing number of Hawaiians maintain that the U.S. presence in Hawaii is an illegal occupation of the Hawaiian kingdom, a legitimate nation state. And that the proof of that is in the absence of a treaty of annexation and legal transfer of title to the land.
The international crime that was committed in 1893 has direct relevance up until today, and it should be understood as an international crime, not a civil rights issue. This is not the same as African Americans or minority groups. This is an indigenous issue.
Mana Kalelani Kateras, musician and activist, came out for the vigil when it began at 4 a.m.
But a lot of the people who live in Hawaii are so Americanized, and they got so much faith in the American system that justice will prevail. Well, justice isn't prevailing today. And that's the most important, if not the only reason why everybody needs to stand up and let everybody know that we are not okay with this. The Hawaiian people, the Kanaka Maoli, are not okay with this, period. We could never be okay with this. 116 years ago, they took this land illegally. We weren't okay with it then, and we're not okay with it now.
The land in question adds up to almost half of the entire archipelago, something Hawaiians say is their birthright. But for all Hawaiians, resistance to the state goes far beyond U.S. laws.
These are Hawaiian lands. When you walk on these lands, you walk on the ancestors of our people, the Hawaiians. When you dig up these lands, the bones that you find are Hawaiian bones. So this is Hawaiian lands.
The court is expected to rule on the case sometime in the next 3 months. For FSRN, I'm Ann Kayala Kelly, reporting from Honolulu.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, multiple studies have estimated that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded that country back in 2003. The exact number of civilians killed is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts on civilian casualties in the conflict. You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. This weekend's weather, cloudy, some rain, and high temperatures right around 50.
A survey finds Tennessee residents are experiencing breathing problems, stress, and anxiety near where more than a billion gallons of coal ash sludge spilled from a power plant storage facility. Last month, the State Health Department interviewed 368 residents within a mile-and-a-half radius of the coal-fired Kingston Fossil Plant. The plant is run by the Tennessee Valley Authority, the nation's largest public utility company. Ash surged into a neighborhood and a river when a containment wall broke in December. A third of survey respondents said they received worsening upper respiratory symptoms. About half reported mental health issues, indicating stress and anxiety.
The nation's leading Arab American rights group filed a complaint today about a series of immigration raids in 2004 that targeted Arabs. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee alleges that the civil rights of Arab Americans were violated during the raids, which were carried out under the name Operation Frontline. The raids were carried out by the Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement and supposedly meant to protect the nation from terrorism during the 2004 elections. But information obtained by the Arab rights group from the government shows that the raids targeted foreign nationals from Muslim-majority countries with no connections to any terrorist groups. None of those arrested in the raids were charged with terrorism, and only 18% were charged with anything at all. Of those, the vast majority were charged with immigration violations. The most common charge was overstaying a visa.
The U.S. National Guard announced today that they'll be leaving the city of New Orleans after serving 3.5 years as a standing army in the city. KBOO's Maggie Starr reports the announcement is being met with mixed feelings from New Orleans residents.
3.5 years after Hurricane Katrina, the National Guard will pull its last troops out of New Orleans this weekend. The National Guard has been assisting the New Orleans police force, but the state is facing a budget crisis and cannot afford to keep the guard in place. There are only about 100 soldiers left in the city, and the last of them will leave after a final patrol on Sunday. Guardsmen have been patrolling sparsely occupied areas of New Orleans that were hit hard by Katrina. One of those areas was the Ninth Ward, which was devastated by the storm. Andy Howell has lived in the Ninth Ward for 3 years. He worked in hurricane relief and helped to start the New Orleans Women's Shelter. He's had negative experiences with the National Guard.
I recall the first interaction I had with them, where they came and were putting bottles on top of cars and shooting the bottles off of the cars, and then pointing laser pointers from their rifles at people walking through. And one man, and that's where he had a panic attack and had to go into the hospital. They are very racist. I remember having an incident at the women's shelter and seeing a young man walk by with baggy pants on, and the sergeant turning to the other sergeant and saying that he likes it better that way. That way, when they have to run from us, their pants will fall around their ankles and they can't get away.
When the guard leaves, the New Orleans Police Department will take over security for the whole city. Some residents are concerned about the police department's capabilities. Tom Pepper is operations director for Common Ground, a hurricane relief organization.
The New Orleans Police Department is still, you know, grossly understaffed. And I mean, you know, the National Guard here, as unpleasant as that may have been, was our only source of police presence here in the area where we are in the Lower Ninth Ward. And, you know, and of course we're, you know, saddened that we're not going to have this sort of a routine drive-by of a policing presence here in this area. And hopefully the city of New Orleans will be able to step up to the plate and provide the same type of services. You know, even though the full pre-Katrina population has not returned, the areas that used to incorporate Greater New Orleans are being reoccupied as residents come back and rebuild their homes. And although there may be fewer people, there is still the need to, you know, police the Greater New Orleans area.
Andy Howell also has doubts about the New Orleans police force.
I don't feel like the New Orleans Police Department will be any better. My only concern is my interactions with the National Guard and the New Orleans Police Department were that the National Guard would respond a lot quicker when there were threats to people, when someone's life was in danger, or if someone was being threatened. And the NOPD would generally respond quicker if there was a threat to property, it seemed. In my mind, that's where their concern lied.
But with money troubles in the state of Louisiana, the New Orleans Police Department is all that the city will have. For KBOO News, I'm Maggie Starr.
Critics started voicing opposition today after President Obama announced his plans for Iraq. Mr. Obama said that after the 19-month troop downturn, he's proposed, or a drawdown, we should say, that he's proposed, there will still be as many as 50,000 U.S. troops stationed in Iraq. Meanwhile, the $3.6 million budget plan he released yesterday includes an increase in defense spending. If he gets his way, the new president will spend more on the military than President George W. Bush. Free Speech Radio's Tanya Snyder has more.
Obama supporters who thought they were voting for a dramatically different war policy have had a rude awakening.
Right now, it seems as if President Obama is staying the course somewhat on our U.S. military strategy.
Joe Comerford is the executive director of the National Priorities Project. She says the numbers that came out this week don't have a lot of detail attached to them, leaving analysts like herself with more questions than answers.
We wonder, actually, if he has begun to take out the Cold War weapon systems as promised, like the F-22 or other things, if he's already taken out portions of the nuclear weapons costs. If he's taking those out, then why aren't we seeing some savings?
Two separate sets of defense numbers have been released. Obama asked for $534 billion for the Pentagon for 2010, without a lot of details about how the money will be spent. At the same time, he asked for $75.5 billion in additional funding for 2009 to fight the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Comerford says that's a record.
President Obama, in the $75.5 billion war supplemental, actually okayed more money than the Bush administration asked for. The Bush administration was planning on asking for something like $69 billion. So we've got more coming from a Democrat than we did projected from a Republican.
The new budget also includes modest increases for the State Department's diplomatic activities. But the National Priorities Project notes that the U.S. will still be spending 13 times more on the Pentagon than on the State Department. At the same time, Obama announced his plan to withdraw troops from Iraq, one of his signature campaign promises. His plan is to withdraw about two-thirds of the troops within the next 16 months. 35,000 to 50,000 so-called non-combat troops will remain in place until the end of 2011. Defense Secretary Robert Gates told reporters that the policy shift toward a firm timeline for withdrawal was a positive step.
And I think that the date provides a way of delineating when one mission in Iraq ends and a completely new and different one begins. So I think that the date is important. It's important for our troops to know. It's important for the Iraqis to know.
The staggered withdrawal and the designation of non-combat status for the remaining troops doesn't satisfy Stacey Hafley of Military Families Speak Out.
A troop is a troop. You know, boots on the ground are boots on the ground. A bullet will hit a non-combat troop just as easily as it will a combat one.
Hafley says leaving troops in the country means the policy hasn't really changed.
As long as we still have people there, we are still an occupying force, and that still is that constant agitation in their country that the Iraqi people have already said they don't want to stay there. All it does is put our loved ones in a dangerous situation with not enough people to fight.
Hafley's husband and sister have served in Iraq and returned with post-traumatic stress disorder. Her brother-in-law is still there. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
Nonviolent protests were held in Palestine today in the villages of Belayin and Nalin to oppose the Israeli wall being constructed on village land. Also, Israeli authorities announced a plan to displace 1,400 Palestinians in Jerusalem. John Smith and Ghazan Benoura from the International Middle East Media Center have more.
The residents of Belayin, near the central West Bank city of Ramallah, marched towards the wall today following Friday prayers in a protest joined by Israeli and international activists. Protesters called for national unity among Palestinians, resistance to the occupation, and condemned Israel's latest decision to demolish Palestinian homes in the Bustan neighborhood of Silwan in Jerusalem. The protest headed towards the wall, which is built by Israel on Belayin's farmland. An Israeli army unit was stationed at the side of the wall and prevented the crowd from passing through the gate toward the agricultural land. The army shot tear gas canisters to disperse the crowd, causing dozens to suffer gas inhalation. Meanwhile, scores of villagers from Nilin, also near Ramallah, held their weekly protest at midday Friday. Villagers, accompanied by international and Israeli demonstrators, protested against the illegal Israeli wall being built on the village's land. Demonstrators carried banners calling for national unity and support for the Palestinians in Jerusalem. As soon as villagers and the international supporters arrived in the area where Israel is building the wall, soldiers showered them with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. Four were injured by rubber-coated steel bullets and dozens received treatment for gas inhalation. For IMEMC.org, this is John Smith.
The latest Israeli demolition plan would displace at least 1,400 Palestinians. The plan announced by Israeli media this week is to take over 88 homes in Al-Bustan neighborhood located immediately south of Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem's Old City. The head of the MABS department at Orient House in Jerusalem says this is not a new plan.
This is an old new Israeli policy, meaning it's a battle of demographics inside the city of Jerusalem, which means it's an implementation to the 2020 Jerusalem project that is minimizing the number of Palestinian residents of Jerusalem. In addition, it's an implementation of the historical annexation project Israel is trying to conclude.
In 2005, the Israeli government issued demolition orders for each home in the area on the grounds of not having the correct license. Since then, local NGOs and homeowners, alongside with a team of engineers, have worked to meet all Israeli requirements and planning laws. Yet permission has still been denied by Israel. Hassan Al-Qadi, the owner of a home in Al-Bustan, explains.
My house consists of two floors. It was built 140 to 150 years ago. A while ago, we had a meeting with the Israeli Interior Ministry. They told us that our planning permit was denied. A few days later, the municipality planners, along with police, came and took photos and measurements of some homes in the area. Since then, we have a protest tent here.
Since Israel occupied the city of Jerusalem in 1967, the authorities have rarely given Palestinian residents permission to build homes and deem many pre-existing structures to have been built without permission. Legal avenues have so far failed to protect Palestinian residents. If this plan goes ahead, local activists state that this could be the largest displacement of Palestinians from Jerusalem by Israel since the 1967 war. For IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
You've been listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we're open to your participation. Just call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kyle Burns, Julie Derrick, and Maggie Starr. Our engineer, Rebecca Ney. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM, on translator K220HR. I'm Jamie Hine.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now!, hosted by Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey speak with activist and writer Randy Shaw, author of Beyond the Fields, Cesar Chavez, the UFW, and the Struggle for Justice in the 21st Century. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Laurie Mercier talks with environmental law professor Mary Woods. They'll discuss what citizens are doing about global warming. Bill Resnick interviews labor movement journalist Sam Pizzicati about Obama's economic program. And Clayton Margridge comments on biology and progressive politics. At 10, it's a new time for Air Cascadia with Chris Andre and myself. At 10:15 on If You Love This Planet, Dr. Helen Caldicott interviews Dr. Marcia Engel, pharmaceutical companies and their influence on medical professionals and the health industry in the U.S. At 11, Health Watch at a new time. Dr. David Naiman speaks with Dr. Courtney Jackson about food intolerances, how to identify them, and why. At 11:30 on Sounds of Awareness, Paul Van Dyke speaks with Dr. Chris Cook, a successful naturopathic physician who's blind, about her work. Now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roast. Good night, Jamie.
Good night, Liam.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, the on-air rant by CNBC reporter Rick Santelli is making the media rounds, promoted by the network itself in good part. But did Santelli's outburst about the Obama White House bailing out losers with its mortgage proposal even make sense? We'll hear from Ryan Chittum from Columbia Journalism Review's The Audit. Also on the show, despite mounting evidence against it and precious little for it, the myth of the liberal media just won't die. A new scholarly study of nightly news coverage of U.S. elections takes another whack at the myth using a novel approach. We'll speak with Mary Elizabeth Graba, associate professor at Indiana University, about the book Image Bite Politics, News and the Visual Framing of Elections. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
If there's one thing you can always count on the media to screw up, it's Social Security. Thanks to a long and well-funded campaign to convince people that the system faces imminent financial collapse, reporters take such claims more or less at face value. Take the February 23rd New York Times, which addressed Social Security's looming financing shortfall by mentioning cuts in benefits along with tax hikes as possible fixes. As the Times put it, quote, "Any solution," budget analysts said, "must include a mix of both approaches," close quote. But again, there is no looming Social Security shortfall. Long-term projections indicate that with no changes made, the system would only start to face problems in the year 2041. And it's not clear where budget analysts would derive the need to slash people's benefits, money people paid into the system, when that long-term shortfall could be solved with minor adjustments, including tax increases. The next day, the Associated Press's Liz Sidoti was mishearing Barack Obama on the issue. She quoted Obama saying that Social Security is, quote, "the single most pressing fiscal challenge we face by far," close quote. That would, given the reality, be a very strange thing for anyone to say, and it turns out Obama was actually talking about health care costs. How could a reporter make such an error and it make it to press unremarked? It's hard to say, but perhaps someone's been hearing too much credulous media talk about Social Security's looming collapse.
An AP fact check of Obama's latest speech on February 24th demonstrates the need for a minimum standard, a gotcha threshold, if you will, for fact-checking features. For instance, when AP reporters Calvin Woodward and Jim Kuhnhen respond to Obama's line that the economic crisis came about because regulations were gutted for the sake of a quick profit at the expense of a healthy market, by writing, quote, "This may be so, but it isn't only Republicans who pushed for deregulation of the financial industries," close quote. Well, that's not a fact check. Obama didn't say he blamed only Republicans, and falsely attributing a sentiment to someone so you can debunk it is unethical. When Obama says of his mortgage bailout proposal, "It's a plan that won't help speculators or that neighbor down the street who bought a house he could never hope to afford, but it will help millions of Americans who are struggling with declining home values," the AP reporters respond, quote, "If the administration has come up with a way to ensure money does not go to home buyers who used bad judgment, it hasn't announced it," close quote. That's not a fact check either, not an accurate one, minus the acknowledgement that there are requirements in the mortgage bailout plan that at least attempt to target it at more diligent borrowers. Now, AP could have described those requirements and let people decide how effective they would have been at screening out irresponsible borrowers, or they could have made an argument that the rules would be inadequate to achieve Obama's stated goals. Either of those would have been informative. Instead, they produced a fact-check piece that was itself in need of fact-checking.
A recent editorial in the New Republic laments that corporate media is suffering from a crisis of legitimacy. What's surprising is that the culprit responsible for media's downward spiral is not journalists themselves, but the combined grouching of media critics from the left and right that has fomented an anti-media backlash and is destroying the media's authority in the culture. Well, after deriding right-wing media critic Bernard Goldberg, the editorial takes on the left. In the left's view of things, quote, it was the timid, lazy press corps that failed to rigorously challenge the president's core, mendacious claims about his tax cuts and rationale for heading to war. Very valid criticism. But these specific objections morphed into populist broadsides against what the left came to describe as the mainstream media, avatars of establishmentarian groupthink who bend to the latest conventional wisdom emerging from D.C. cocktail parties and neurotically fret that they might just be as biased as their conservative critics allege, close quote. Well, cutting through the caricature, what's the difference between left press criticism and valid criticism again? Corporate media do rely on Beltway insiders who do dispense Beltway conventional wisdom. The sales job on the Iraq War was an example of that, not an exception. As for what reporters neurotically fret about, that's not the concern of much progressive media criticism. And as for destroying the corporate media's authority in the culture, well, one can only hope.
The New York Times' Elizabeth Buhlmiller showed a willingness to serve official over public needs as a White House correspondent, famously explaining that as a reporter, you can't just say the president is lying, even if it's, well, true. If her February 24th piece is any evidence, Buhlmiller is now bringing her airbrush to Pentagon issues. The story, headlined "From a Carrier, Another View of America's Air War in Afghanistan," read a lot like pro-military propaganda, with lines like, quote, pilots circle Taliban strongholds like an airborne 911 service and zoom in, close quote. And this one, quote, from 15,000 feet up, the pilots protect supply lines under increasing attack, fly reconnaissance missions to find what they call bad guys over the next hill, and go kinetic with bombs that kill 3, 4, or 5 Taliban fighters at a time, close quote. A piece about airstrikes in Afghanistan can't completely avoid mentioning civilian casualties, but the Times underscores that they are scrupulously avoided. Just ask, well, the U.S. military. Quote, as Vice Admiral William E. Gortney, the commander of United States naval forces in the region, put it, we don't drop when we're unsure, close quote. But might there be legitimate cause to doubt such reassurances? Yes, if you think back to, say, the February 21st New York Times, which carried a story from Kabul which led, an airstrike by the United States-led military coalition killed 13 civilians and 3 militants last Tuesday in western Afghanistan, not up to 15 militants, as was initially claimed by American forces, military officials here said Saturday.
And finally, after a heavy barrage of criticism over Washington Post columnist George Will's error-filled February 15th column on climate change, the paper's new ombud put out a response, which, rather than clearing Will, managed to reveal how the columnist gets away with such falsehoods. Will's original column included 3 significant problems. He misrepresented scientific research in the 1970s by claiming that cooling was the prevailing concern. He misrepresented University of Illinois research on global sea ice. And he claimed that UN climate researchers have found, quote, no recorded global warming for more than a decade, close quote. Post ombud Andy Alexander explained that Will's column was checked by no less than 5 editors, including the op-ed page editor. In Will's defense, Alexander took up only the sea ice issue, citing a University of Illinois statement that he claimed supported Will. In fact, as the blog Political Animal pointed out, if Alexander had read a little more closely, he would have realized that the statement was written specifically to refute an analysis similar to Will's. In other words, the ombud offered an expert refutation of Will's argument as evidence that Will was correct. Alexander's response was seconded by Washington Post Writers Group editorial director Alan Shearer, who told the blog Think Progress, quote, "We have plenty of references that support what George wrote, and we have others that dispute that, so we didn't have enough to send in a correction," close quote. This is perhaps even more bizarre than Alexander's take. The group whose research Will is misrepresenting has said his column is inaccurate. Wouldn't their views about their own research carry more weight than other references that back up Will?
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The ongoing financial crisis and the government responses to it are among the most important stories of the era. Clear reporting is a real public service. What do we make, then, of media's eagerness to make a phenomenon from CNBC reporter Rick Santelli's self-described rant against the White House mortgage bailout plan? "The government is promoting bad behavior," Santelli cried from a floor of Chicago Traders. He encouraged, shall we say, Obama to put up a website to have people vote on the internet as a referendum to see if we really want to subsidize the losers' mortgages. Santelli's heated performance has been replayed numerous times now, partly as infotainment, but also as illustration, we're told, of real popular anger and resentment. Our next guest says Santelli's outburst says less about him than the media subculture in which he functions. Ryan Chittum writes for Columbia Journalism Review's business section, The Audit. He's a former Wall Street Journal reporter. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Ryan Chittum.
Thanks.
Well, you and we both think this is about something more than Rick Santelli, who says ranting is his shtick. But let's start with the substance of his remarks. He said people don't want to pay for their neighbors' mistakes and want instead to reward people who could carry the water instead of drink the water. Well, strange metaphors aside, what's wrong with Santelli's rant on its merits?
I think that he's certainly tapped into a rich vein of anger in the citizenry. There's no question about that. But what's wrong with what he's saying is that I think, and a lot of people think, that most of the people in this crisis aren't there due solely to their own mistakes or their own, you know, greediness, like I want a house I can't afford or whatever. Sure, there are a ton of people who got too much house. And within that group, there are a lot who knew what they were doing and knew better and just thought, you know, this thing's going up and I'm going to try to get in on it. But many of the people who got subprime loans, for instance, which have instigated this crisis, they qualify for prime loans. What Santelli and others are missing was there is a epidemic of fraud. That's not too strong a word to say. In the mortgage industry, created by pressure from investors who wanted yield on investments, Wall Street created those investments, put pressure on mortgage companies, who put pressure on mortgage brokers, who put people in loans that were worse than they deserved. Fannie Mae looked at their 2005 loans, I believe that was the vintage, and found that about half of the subprime loans, the people who got them, qualified for prime mortgages. So these people were paying God knows how much more a month. Their interest rates were higher. They were probably in adjustable rate mortgages, maybe no principal, interest-only mortgages that suddenly balloon. Brokers, it's well established, conned millions of people into getting loans that they didn't really understand what they were. And people don't want to accept that. There's an asymmetry of information when a financial professional is across the table from somebody who may do this once or twice in their lifetime. The financial professional has a significant advantage. It's not as simple as, why didn't the buyer read their terms? It's just not that simple. I mean, my parents, for instance, got an adjustable rate mortgage after I specifically warned them not to let somebody put them in an ARM. So this is not as simple as some people want to make it out to be.
Well, some commenters to your posts and in other places talking about Santelli have said, you look, he was upset about the Wall Street bailout, too. You know, he also right. was irritated about that. But you have been following this guy. You know his sure. various rants. His talk about the Wall Street bailout somehow didn't become the most watched clip on CNBC's website and replayed and talked about on the Sunday chat shows.
I unfortunately have to watch a lot of it, CNBC, as part of my job. I mean, I don't want to flag them too much. I mean, they do some good stuff, but it's not my favorite thing. But his fervor wasn't nearly so much when he was talking about the Wall Street bailouts. You know, he wasn't talking about tea parties then, and that was trillions of dollars as opposed to $75 million going directly to homeowners, $275 as a package. The question is, why didn't that stuff take off? For one thing, it wasn't as spectacular a television to watch his complaints, which I've linked to in my post if listeners want to check that out, some of his complaints about the Wall Street bailouts. He would talk about, you know, he's an Ayn Randian, basically, sort of a market fundamentalist. And he'd say, you know, maybe we shouldn't do this. He didn't really question the need for it. He questioned the timing of it. We should delay this. We shouldn't rush into this. And this is a specific incident I'm talking about. It was in the middle of September when capitalism in our was melting down. And I believe, and many others believe, had the government not stepped in, as flawed as the TARP was, we'd be in a big-time 1932-style depression right now. So that's one reason. It just wasn't as good a television. Second of all, it's sort of playing into, I think, a right-wing theme. And as always, the journalists are sensitive about being portrayed as being liberal. And this clearly sparked a chord in a segment of the population and allowed the media to say, oh, look at this, we're not right-wing, we're covering this too. I think that's an element of it.
Well, finally and briefly, this Santelli phenomenon is clearly to some degree heat over light, but I want to make clear that you have pointed out that there is good reporting going on, illuminating, non-invidious reporting going on. To the extent that we're saying some of the anger that's out there is being misdirected by misdirected coverage, do you think better coverage could ameliorate some of this neighbor-on-neighbor resentment?
Yeah, that's something we have talked about at CJR and the audit. That's been one of our themes, is that the press really, you know, we've read all about the mortgage crisis, people losing their houses, but I still don't think the press has accurately portrayed the sick stuff that was really going on in the mortgage industry and how that all leads to Wall Street, which enabled this boom, created it essentially. My boss, Dean Startman, wrote a piece called Boiler Room in the fall for the magazine. It's really kind of a good synopsis of stuff that's out there that I think most readers haven't read about. Most people haven't heard that half of people who got subprime loans qualify for prime loans. They just haven't heard that. Why is that? The press likes to think, you know, oh, we've covered it. It has a bias towards the new. We don't want to do something we've already done or somebody else has already done. But this is something of such magnitude that it requires us to go back in and do the deep dives and repeatedly flesh it out, what happened, so people know what it is. It's easy for people to get a soundbite of, oh, these bum homeowners, they caused this mess. It's much harder to understand a collateralized debt obligation and the credit default swaps that enabled the issuers to create more of those and the pressure that went on down the chain to mortgage companies. And the mortgage brokers who con people into signing loans that they couldn't afford, you know, it takes a longer attention span to understand that. You can't really put that in a soundbite. So I think that's part of the problem, too.
We've been speaking with Ryan Chittum. You can find his work at CJR's business section, The Audit, at CJR.org. Thank you very much, Ryan Chittum, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
For all its currency in U.S. media discussions, serious studies documenting the left-wing bias of U.S. news media are hard to come by. Sure, there have been polls with small samples showing reporters preferred the centrist Bill Clinton over the conservative George Bush the Elder, and there was a 2005 UCLA study that employed a sort of Rube Goldberg design to conclude, among other absurdities, that Rush Limbaugh's favorite website, The Drudge Report, leans left. But that view is challenged by a serious new study authored by Indiana University professors Maria Elizabeth Graba and Eric Busey. Their study, Image Bite Politics, News and the Visual Framing of Elections, just published in book form by Oxford University Press, is, among other things, a visual analysis of nightly news coverage of U.S. presidential campaigns from 1992 to 2004. Co-author Maria Elizabeth Graba joins us now from Indianapolis. Welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you very much for having me.
Virtually every study that FAIR has done of news outlets, including ABC, CBS, NBC, NPR, PBS, and several other letters of the alphabet, has shown that media prefer Republicans over Democrats and conservatives over progressives. Our studies usually look at who the media outlets choose to be sources or guests, a look at who gets to join the media dialogue, if you will. Well, the novel part of your study is that you looked at how sources were presented, the visual imagery. And I wanted to ask you why you chose that way to look at the elections.
We believe that elections are in a media age fought visually. That's why candidates have image handlers. These are the people who orchestrate the images of these candidates in the media. You know, from how their hair should be parted, to the color of the suit, to whose hand they're going to shake, to who are the people very carefully selected to appear in the backdrop of the candidate's speech during a rally. And this has been greatly understudied and underconsidered. And the reason why we think it's so important is because human beings are supreme visual processors. We tune out words and favor visual images to a great degree when we watch TV, for example. If you believe cognitive and neuroscientists, the human brain is wired for visual processing. And the things we looked at influence the visual appearance of candidates on the nightly news.
Well, let's talk about some of the ways that you did look at this coverage visually. You talked about camera angles. Let's start with that camera angles issue.
Experimental studies have shown that if you film a person from eye level and then from a high angle looking down and then from a low angle looking up, and you show that to people during an experimental study and say, who's the most credible? Who is the most powerful? Who is the most leader-like? It's the same person. But people who see the low-angle version of that person...
That is where they're looking up
yes,
at the candidate.
And it attributes power to that person. The people who see the low-angle version report, statistically, higher levels of credibility, of leadership potential, of electability, credibility, and a host of other variables compared to the eye level or the high angle shot that looks down on a person. And you know, psychologists argue that this is so because as children, we experience visually our parents as the first authority figures in our lives, looking up at them just because we're short.
By that standard, then when you applied that to Republicans versus Democrats, what did you find?
Not only do Republicans appear in the favorable low-angle shot more than Democrats, but they appear less in the unfavorable high-angle shot than Democrats. So they benefit both ways. And this is a pretty consistent pattern across all four of the election years that we looked at. And, you know, the thing is here to parse out what is at the volition of the journalist. And mostly, that's the call that a journalist makes, like whether this is going to be eye level, high angle, or low angle. And so, you know, when it is that Republicans are favored with more low angles and fewer high angles than Democrats across four elections, you got to just sit back and say, yeah, something's going on here. That can't be accidental.
You were in television news, and I saw a quote from you that said that television news producers know this.
Of course they do. Any journalism program at the university level teach this. But even in the industry, every camera person and TV news reporter know what the so-called meaning of a low and high angle shot is, and that the eye level is the more fair, balanced
objective, call it what you want, camera angle.
Describe to us what the lip flap effect is and how you applied it to the study.
Lip flap is one of those things that reporters and editors get taught very early on in journalistic training, is that you don't show a person who is kind of in interview mode, in other words, talking, in, say, a close shot. You don't use that as visual material over the reporter's narration. You rather show the candidate, I don't know, shaking hands, kissing babies, whatever, not in speech mode. Because when a viewer looks at a screen and a close-up shot of a candidate and you see this person talking, it's incredibly distracting if you can't hear what that person is saying. It's like a fish gasping for air, right? Lips are moving, but we can't hear it. It's not a very favorable way to present a candidate. And journalists know better. They know not to use that. That lip flap is not a good way to show someone. But yet, it happens.
Now, you also found that was a bias that disfavored Democrats more, too.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I want to get to who gets to speak last in the segment. Why is that important first, and what were your conclusions in the study?
Yeah, again, Republicans overwhelmingly received more last speaking turn opportunities than Democrats. We call this the Goldilocks effect. Experimental research has shown that if you have three viewpoints from three different people, the person who gets to speak first consistently is ranked as less powerful, less credible, less logical, less convincing than the person who speaks last. It's called the primacy recency effect. The first position is too hot. The middle one is too cold, and the last one is just right. That's the last word, so to speak.
Well, and by definition, there's not going to be any rebuttal of what that person says either. I wanted to finally talk. The mainstream media is one of the prime offenders in repeating the myth of the liberal media trope. Are you finding much mainstream interest in your study?
No, I can't say that. Well, it's interesting. I find that it's the radio folks who are most interested in this study. I haven't heard much from...
Well, it's about television.
Yeah, so. Television or newspaper folks. Tip of my hat to the radio folks.
We've been speaking with Maria Elizabeth Graba, associate professor at Indiana University and co-author with Eric Pusey of Image Byte Politics, News and the Visual Framing of Elections, just published by Oxford University Press. Maria Elizabeth Graba, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Of arts coverage from Portland and around the Northwest, with D.May Roberts on stage and studio on Tuesday starting 11 a.m., followed by Arts Focus with Ava Lake at 11:30 a.m. Get your arts news and find out who the movers and shakers are in your community with a full hour of arts and culture Tuesdays from 11 a.m. to 12 noon here on KABU 90.7 FM or online at kabu.fm.
Friday, March 6th, Headlock Music, Rough Cuts Clothing, and KABU Community Radio welcome the fireman Anthony B. to Portland, live and direct, straight out of Jamaica, for a night of conscious roots and dancehall reggae. Doors at 8, show starts at 9, with Don Dignitaries, J. Ross Pirelli, and the Escort Service Band. Small Axe Sound with YT and MC Jaga are in the house as well. All this at Brabati's downtown at Southwest 3rd and Ankeny. A portion of the proceeds of this 21 and over event will benefit KBOO Community Radio. Yes, Anthony B.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Oregon College of Oriental Medicine, providing acupuncture, herbal medicine, and massage from clinic locations in Southeast Portland and the Hollywood District. Information on patient care and degree programs in acupuncture and oriental medicine available at ocom.edu.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, a weekly feminist news and public affairs program. And your host tonight is Jen Lavender. I'm also the Portland Medical Women Organizer, a socialist feminist leadership training organization for women. And you can check us out at www.radicalwomen.org or give us a call at 503-240-4462. Tonight I am playing a oldie but goodie from the archives of Bread and Roses. This is a piece by Gabrielle Ross. It's the American Human Development Project, and it's an interview with New York-based writer and researcher Kristen Lewis, co-director of the American Human Development Project. The project is a nonpartisan, nonprofit initiative to apply a well-established international approach to measuring human well-being in the U.S. The Human Development Index is a fact-based tool that examines health, education, and income, and compares the data across geographic, ethnic, and gender lines within the U.S. and across the globe. The results will surprise you and should steer a national debate. The report includes practical recommendations. And in addition, there is an interview with Jean DeMaster, Director of Human Solutions. DeMaster offers some local data and gives examples for creative responses in addressing issues related to poverty and inequality. Learn about easy ways to become involved. And since we are still experiencing incredible economic struggle and strife in this country, I thought this a very relevant and important interview for all of you. So do stay tuned.
Good evening. You're listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Gabi. I'm hosting the show tonight, and I'm very pleased to introduce something to you that I think should be national headlines. Kristen, are you there?
Yes, I am, Gabby. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And thanks for joining us on the show. I know for you it's rather late. I'm going to talk to Kristen Lewis, who is in New York. She's a researcher and writer and has been for a long time researched and written on international development issues. And Kristen Lewis co-directed the report called The Measure of America, the First American Human Development Report. And before we talk about what that actually is, I want to just congratulate you. I can't begin to imagine how much work went into this report, but also it's, in my opinion, extremely well done. I'm one of these people that doesn't do well with stats and reading reports. But this thing I could not put down. It's not just because the content is incredibly interesting, but also it is just well done. It's easy to read, even for me, who's not an expert in any of these areas. The graphs are really illustrate the point you're trying to make. The maps are great, and there's little stories in there. For example, there is a story of two subway stops in New York. Mm-hmm. That are, what, like a little over a mile apart from each other, 2 miles, and yep. half a century distance in terms of the situation of people who live in those two areas.
Right.
So, before I go any further, what is the First American Human Development Report?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for your kind words. It's wonderful to hear. We really tried to make it a book that was accessible for people who like stats, people who don't like stats, for people who like stories, like pictures, all different things. So I'm happy to hear your reaction. So thanks for that. Our project is the American Human Development Project, and we have funding from a variety of donors, Oxfam America, the Conrad Hilton Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, Social Science Research Council, and the Annenberg Foundation. And it's an independent project, and our aim is to introduce to the U.S. this well-honed and internationally very well-known methodology and approach for judging, engaging, and measuring people's well-being. And it's called the Human Development Approach, and the measure that's used is the Human Development Index. And the UN uses this index to rank all the countries in the world every year according to their well-being. And in addition, developing countries, about 150 of them, often produce these kinds of reports and do this kind of analysis to assess the situation in their own country. But there's never been one before for an industrialized country. So this is the first one.
And I think what we've done in industrialized countries is measured the income. You know, how much people make and how much wealth the country has. And you make a good case in your report why this is not a sufficient measure. Would you like to explain why it is not?
Sure. We do. We focus very much in the U.S. on income measures, and that's how we assess well-being. So every hour we're finding out what is the stock market doing, what is the consumer price index like. People talk a lot about growth and things like this. But and those things are important. They're important, and it's one ingredient of human well-being. But I think all of us know intuitively that that's not the only thing that matters, and that what's also important is how you translate that income into people's well-being. And so we've added to this by saying that you should also measure things like health and education. And the methodology that the Global Report uses does this. It basically takes indicators in health, education, and income, those three areas, and it adds them together and divides by three, in a sense, and gets a number. And so we've done something similar. We've measured health by life expectancy. We've measured knowledge or access to knowledge or education by educational degree attainment and school enrollment. And then we've measured income, which is still important, not the only thing, but still an important thing, by personal earnings. And again, we've added them together and divided by three, and we get a score. And the score by itself doesn't mean a whole lot. When it starts to have meaning is when you disaggregate the population by different groups and then compare the score. So the score, it goes from 0 to 10, and for the country as a whole, it's 5. And that, again, doesn't mean a whole lot. But then if your state is 6 or 7, you're above average. Or if your congressional district is a 3, then you see where you are in the comparisons, how you stack up against other parts of the country, other ethnic groups. And so it's a way to compare in an apples-to-apples kind of way mm-hmm. how different groups of Americans are doing.
And you also still in the report throw the international comparison, which the United States used to be number 2.
And right. That is something we've done. The U.S. up until 1990 was second place in the global human development rankings. And now in 2005 and more recently, we've been number 12. So it's a tumble of 10 places in the course of that time. And the reason for that is not that the U.S. hasn't made some gains in these three areas in that time, but other countries have made much quicker gains. They've been much more efficient at translating their income into well-being for their people than we have.
And if you just tuned in a little late, I'm talking to Kristen Lewis, a researcher and writer who is the co-director of the Measure of America, the first American Human Development Report. The report is available at a reasonable price, so we will give you that information towards the end of the show. I would highly recommend getting it. It's an incredible tool.
Thanks,
Kathy. So in your report, you filter things through geography, ethnicity, gender, wealth distribution. Let's start with geography. What is kind of a highlight looking at the United States in terms of human development and how it looks like across the country?
Well, if you look at the country as a whole, and you look at a map on our website, we have maps of this also. You can see the maps. You can see right away that the Northeast, as an area, as a region of the country, is the area with the highest index score. So overall, on average, people are living the longest, not living the longest, but getting the most education and earning the most. The longest lived people, the healthiest region is actually the West. But then overall, the South in all three indicators is lagging behind the rest of the country. So you really can see that very clearly when you look at the country as a whole. In terms of the states, Connecticut is the state with that ranks the first in our list, and Mississippi is the state that ranks the last. Now, sometimes people hear that and they're not very surprised, and they think, well, where's the news in that? Everyone, you know, knows that Mississippi and the Delta region is struggling, that area has traditionally for many years been at the bottom of this sort of list. But what we found very interesting was the degree of the gap, the degree of the disparity. We calculated the Human Development Index not just for today, but also for the past. So we used the same indicators, but the data from 1960, 70, 80, 90, 2000, and 2005. And this allowed us to create a trend line. And that can then, you can take then groups living today and say, how does their score compare with Americans 10 years ago or 20 years ago? And what we found, for instance, with Mississippi is that Mississippi's score of 3.58 is basically the score of the country as a whole in the late 1980s, whereas Connecticut has a score of 6.37, which, if current trends continue, is where the country as a whole will be in 2020. So that's a gap of more than three decades between Mississippi and Connecticut, which is fairly significant when you think about it. And the differences between among congressional different districts is actually even greater because the population size is smaller. So every congressional district has roughly 650,000 people. And the top-ranked congressional district in the country is Congressional District 14, which is the east side of New York, east side of Manhattan. And so the people living there are living living the longest, having the best education, and earning the most income on average altogether. And the lowest ranked congressional district is not, as one might assume, in the Delta or Appalachia, for instance, but rather around Fresno, California, in the agricultural area there in the Central Valley. And if you look at the differences between these two places, the people living in New York are 10 times more likely to have a college degree, for instance. They're earning 3 times more, and they're even living on average 4.5 years longer. So those are fairly significant differences. And if you look at them in terms of these human development gaps, it's about a 55 or 60 year gap between the top ranked congressional district and the bottom ranked congressional district. And a minute ago, you alluded to the map in New York, or the story about New York. There are two congressional districts, District 14 and District 16, which are about 2 miles apart, 3 subway stops separating them, and 56 years in terms of these human development dimensions. So that's quite striking. Even within a single city, you'll see big gaps like this.
It's like a different country almost. Amazing.
Yeah, very much like a different country. And then, so that's the overall index, but then you can also take the different components of the index, health, education, and income, and find similarly striking findings. You know, they're the lowest ranked congressional district in terms of health is in Kentucky. The top ranked congressional district in terms of health is in Northern Virginia, sort of suburb of Washington, D.C. And there's more than a decade of life expectancy separating those two places. And, you know, 10 years is a long time to have an average.
Mm-hmm. And the different maps I looked at, Oregon seems to generally fall somewhere in the lower middle. Is that correct?
Yeah, Oregon as a whole is, as a state, is ranked 26th. But mm-hmm. then if you look at its, if it's five congressional districts, you have some range there. So the Congressional District 1, which is in the sort of top left corner there of Oregon, that's ranked number 114. But then Congressional District 2 is ranked 349, and that's the eastern part of the state, I think Lake County. So there's quite a difference between the top and the bottom, even within Oregon.
And we will talk about Oregon specifically and Multnomah County a little bit more with somebody else towards the end of the show, so stay tuned for that.
Okay.
You also looked at ethnicity, which to me is also incredible, the differences. You want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, that, again, was full of really striking findings. Overall, in terms of the major sort of racial ethnic groups in the U.S., as defined by the U.S. Census Bureau, Asian Americans are doing the best overall. They have the highest index scores, followed by whites, then Latinos, then American Indians and Native Americans, with African Americans doing the worst on these human development indicators. And there are different reasons why different ethnic groups are in these different places on this list. Asians are far ahead in education, I mean by a mile, and then they're also ahead in health, so they're the longest lived group. And these two dimensions, particularly education, really drives their number one ranking. Just to give an example, about half of Asian Americans have a bachelor's degree compared to 30% of whites, 17% of African Americans, and 12% of Latinos. So, and they're similarly ahead in terms of graduate degree attainment. So really their educational attainment is pushing them to the top of the list. Latinos, on the other hand, they're third on the list overall, but they're the second healthiest. And the reason they're ending up third on the list is that they're second healthiest because they have also the lowest score in education and also the lowest score in terms of earnings. So nonetheless, their very good health scores pull them up the list. And it's interesting, there's something called the Latino paradox, which is that when Latinos come to the U.S. from another country, they're longer lived on average than Americans. But as they live here longer, their life expectancy decreases. So they're getting less healthy when they're here. And one reason for that is that they're less likely to have health insurance once they get here than other Americans. African Americans, as I mentioned earlier, are on the bottom of this well-being list. And the reason is their health. It's largely their health because they're in the middle of the pack in terms of education and income, but they have the poorest health by far. So African American babies, for instance, are 2.5 times more likely to die before age one than the average American baby. And African Americans in general have a shorter lifespan than the average American in the late 1970s. And the situation is particularly dire for African American men who are living shorter lives than the average American did in 1960, you know, nearly half a century ago. So that's a real challenge and a very serious and worrying statistic.
And since you keep mentioning health, what I find staggering, too, is that the United States spends more money on healthcare than any other country in the world, but we really don't benefit much from it.
No, it's really shocking because we spend more money in absolute terms and also as a percentage of our GDP than any other country in the world, and yet we're ranked number 42 in the world in terms of life expectancy. So we're not getting very much return on our investment.
And 1 in 6 Americans is without health insurance. Infant mortality rates don't look so great.
No. The health insurance, you know, 47 million Americans don't have health insurance. And in addition to that, within a given two-year period, about 60 million more Americans don't have health insurance for some period of time. Now, this situation is completely unheard of in any other industrialized country. All European countries, the Nordic countries, they have all found some way to cover all of their population with health insurance. And they don't always use the same model. You know, some have universal single-payer systems. Some have a hybrid with public and private sector. They have accounts where you have to pay yourself. They have millions of different combinations. So we're not advocating any one or the other approach. But what we are saying is that most every other, all of our peer countries can do it, and I'm sure we can too. And it really would be a tremendously helpful thing for us as a country in terms of that. You mentioned infant mortality. One very sad statistic is that if we had the same infant mortality rate as the number one country in the world in terms of infant mortality, by number one I mean having the lowest infant mortality rate, which is Sweden, then 21,000 more American babies would have lived to celebrate their first birthday in 2005. So that's it's a very real, has very real consequences for, you know, 21,000 families out there.
Mm-hmm. Again, I'm speaking with Kristen Lewis, co-director of the Measure of America, the first American Human Development Report, which was pretty recently published, I believe.
Yeah, we just launched it a few weeks ago.
You also looked at gender, and I found that quite interesting, too. Gender and ethnicity combined, but also gender by itself.
Yeah. One of our interesting findings in terms of gender is that men of every racial and ethnic group make more money than do their female counterparts. Yet women in every ethnic group except for Asian Americans have a higher educational score than the men in their group do. So women, on the whole, are getting more education and earning less money. Actually, Asian women and white women would have the highest human development index except for income. It's income that's pulling them down. So women have, you know, greater life expectancy and more education, but these two gains, these two superior scores, are basically wiped out by the earnings difference. So men and women have about the same human development index score. They're not statistically different, but the contributors to the score are completely different. Women, it's health and education, and men, it's income. In terms of education, Asian men have the highest score, and Latino men have scored the lowest by a significant margin. So just as African American men are facing a real challenge in terms of health, so too are Latino men facing a real education challenge. In terms of health, Asian women are living the longest, followed by Latino women. And as I mentioned earlier, African American men are living the shortest lives. The largest earning gaps between men and women within a racial and ethnic group is among whites. So that's a $14,000 difference between men and women. That's quite a sizable difference because we're looking, again, at median personal earnings. And so that's the money, not household earnings, but the money you as a person earn through your labor. Mm-hmm. And the average for the country is around $27,000. So $14,000 is quite a big difference to have as an average gap between men and women.
And you devote quite a bit of time to what that means, what poverty means, what it means in terms of the American dreams, in terms of social mobility. Mm-hmm. And again, the United States is different than other countries in that regard.
Well, I think we are different also from what we think we are. I think that most Americans believe that we are a country that is much more mobile in terms of social mobility than our European countries, for instance. But more recent research is showing that a child born into poverty in a lot of our peer countries actually has a better chance of ending up in the middle class as an adult than does an American child born into poverty today. And I think that's very different than our national story we tell about ourselves and what we like to believe, and, you know, which probably was true in the past, but it seems to be becoming less true.
And you devote actually a large chapter to education and all the really complex reasons. I work in education, and what I hear often is some people just don't care about it, and that's why they don't perform well. But it's, according to your findings, it's much more complicated than that.
It really is. It really is very complicated. And the thing about education is that it really is building on what you already know. So when kids come to school and for 5 years old for kindergarten, there are already disparities before they've even started their formal education, and significant ones, you know, between children who are middle class or are having a privileged upbringing with parents who have a lot of education, for instance, and kids whose parents are maybe didn't graduate from high school. The gap in vocabulary and in all sorts of measures of school readiness is already fairly large before they even start school. And, you know, success builds on success. And so, and also if you're starting behind, it becomes very difficult to catch up and the gap widens. And then the problem is that kids then often go to very different quality schools. So the child whose parents maybe are already well educated, who's already getting a good start in terms of vocabulary and all sorts of non-cognitive skills like impulse control and things like that, they're then going to probably on average, not every child of course, but on average going to a school with better trained teachers and better resources. They're having more enriching activities after school. So over the course of the school experience, the gap is actually widening between middle class and privileged kids on the one hand and disadvantaged kids on the other. And the problem is it seems right now that there's not a social problem for which the answer doesn't seem to be, you know, change education, more education, a different kind of education. But we're really giving to schools such a heavy burden basically to solve all of the social problems we have in this country and not really giving them very much in the way of resources to be equal to that task. So it's a real challenge.
Mm-hmm. How about wealth distribution in the United States or trends in the gaps and what that looks like?
Between the post-war period, the mid-40s, better said, to like the mid-70s or so, the economy grew and the benefits of the growth of the economy were largely shared. So sure, you know, there were still richer people and poorer people, but on the whole, we grew together as a country. Whereas since the mid-70s, we've been growing apart. You know, the economy is still growing, but a smaller and smaller segment of the population is getting the lion's share of those benefits, basically. So just to give you a few examples, right now, if you look at the top 1% of American households, the top 1% is earning 20% of the income, and they possess a full third, 33%, of the wealth of the country, just the top 1%. Whereas if you look at the bottom 60% of households, so, you know, significantly more than half, 60%, they're earning 22% of the income, but they only possess 4% of the wealth. So 60% of the American households are possessing 4% of the wealth, and 1% at the top is possessing 33%. So income disparity is quite significant, and even more significant is the wealth disparity.
And as your report illustrates very well, it's all interconnected, the wealth and the health and the education, and then you pick some specific issues such as mental illness or AIDS or homelessness.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you look at the income and wealth, for instance. Wealth is, you know, income is sort of what you're using to meet your daily needs and so forth, but wealth is the thing that protects you in times of an economic downturn or if you get sick, or it's what allows you to buy a house in a good school district to give your kids a leg up. It's what allows you to pay for college without, you know, bankrupting yourself and all these kinds of things. So all, you know, they are mutually very reinforcing.
You also look at some states that seem to be doing things right in some aspects. For example, Minnesota. You want to say something about that?
Sure. You know, we looked, as I said earlier, we did take apart the index sort of and rank the states, better said, in terms of their income, in terms of their health, in terms of their education. And Hawaii was number one in terms of longevity, and but Hawaii is such a wonderful place. We thought that we could make a really good case. Everyone would just assume you would want to live long if you're living in Hawaii because it's so lovely. So we took number two, Minnesota, and we tried to explore why is Minnesota number two in terms of longevity. Like, what are they doing that's different from what the rest of the country is doing? And there were a few findings. One is that they have higher levels of physical activity there than do residents of other states. Their babies are healthier. Minnesota has a very low infant mortality rate, and including the lowest infant mortality rate for non-Hispanic black mothers in the United States. It invests more in public health than do most states. There's not as much income inequality in Minnesota as there is in other parts of the country. And there's high rates of insurance. You know, lack of health insurance really is an early death sentence. So a state like Minnesota, which has higher rates of insurance, only 7% of Minnesotans are without health insurance, are having longer lives.
And your report concludes with a set of recommendations overall to address some of these discrepancies. Would you say a little bit about that? What you would recommend to improve some of these?
Sure. We did try to cast our recommendations very much in the spirit of what would it take to increase the scores of especially the areas being left behind right now, but also the country as a whole. You know, how can we boost our score? And so in terms of a long and healthy life, we argue that promoting prevention and making healthcare affordable for our Americans are really the key to increasing longevity. You know, all of the gains, not all the gains, but most of the gains in life expectancy in the last half of the 20th century came from public health measures. They came from things like warnings on cigarette packages, seatbelt laws, speed limits, helmets, all these kinds of things that protect our health in a preventative way. That's what made us live longer. And we invest very little in comparison to what we invest in end-of-life care and medical treatments in prevention. But, you know, prevention, this idea of prevention being nine-tenths of the cure is actually quite true. And then making health care affordable for all Americans. You know, it's just this health insurance question. I mean, we just can't really continue on as we're doing and expect to have any gains in life expectancy. In terms of access to knowledge, we really need to address the big disparities that we have in our public school system. It's just kind of shocking. We all know it. We hear the things. But to really look at it all as of a piece, you know, 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education, we still have two separate school systems. And we can't really do very much until we address that. And then another priority for education is really investing in at-risk kids very early with pre-K and other preschool education that's high quality. The problem is a little bit is that people think that they can just take a few elements of high-quality preschools and then it will have the same results, but it doesn't. It really requires a real investment, you know, in college-educated teachers and long days and enriching materials. And, you know, we need to do that for those kids, but also for all of our society. And there have been so many studies that show that $1 invested in an at-risk kid, an at-risk young child, pays back anywhere from, you know, $5 to $17 in terms of the benefits to that child and to society as a whole in terms of reduced public assistance use, higher rates of high school and college graduation and things like that. So it's really a worthwhile investment. And in terms of income, we had a couple of recommendations. One was to try to create asset building programs. The UK has a great new program called the Baby Bond Act, where they create it's like a savings bond for every newborn who's born. And asset building programs like that would be very helpful to address the big differences we have in the U.S. in terms of assets. And then strengthening and supporting families is another recommendation. You know, the U.S. is one of only four countries in the entire world. We're in the company of Liberia, Swaziland, and Papua New Guinea as one of only four countries that doesn't have federally mandated paid maternity leave. You know, today there's a new normal, and that new normal is that two parents are in the workforce or single parents are in the workforce. And we haven't really adjusted as a society to that in terms of helping out. You know, all of our peer countries have adjusted. They have federally mandated paternity leave and maternity leave and leaves for breastfeeding and annual leave that you can use to care for a sick loved one and all these things that help families care for one another. And we're very behind in that way. And then our last recommendations are to sort of launch a Marshall Plan for the Gulf region, which has been traditionally lagging behind, took the horrible blow of Hurricane Katrina, from which it's still reeling. And as a nation, we really need to to lend a hand in a more meaningful way down there. And last but not least is taking responsibility for the most vulnerable people in our society. And what we mean here are people with persistent and severe mental illness, for instance, and other populations who fall through the cracks. You know, we owe it to them and to their families to not sort of abandon them in a sense.
Thank you so much for Kristen Lewis, co-director of the Measure of America, the first American Human Development Report. How can people access this report?
A lot of our material is on our website, which is measureofamerica.org. There we have maps that you can map our index, as well as the components of the index, but then also about 50 other dimensions. So you can map SAT scores by state, or prison rates, or percentage of the young people going into the military, carbon dioxide emissions, you know, all sorts of things you can map. So we have very interactive tools. We have on there something called the Wellometer, where you can figure out an approximation of your own personal human development index score. And then we have various excerpts from the book on there as well. If you wanted to buy the book, it's on Amazon.com. It's also in Barnes & Noble Bookstore.
And again, the website is
www.measureofamerica.org, right.
And if you missed that, give the station a call, and I'll be happy to call you back. Any parting words on this fabulous piece of work?
Oh, just to thank you so much for your enthusiasm and interest in the book. I really appreciate it.
I have one last question. What is sure. your vision of what should happen with this report?
Well, you know, we hope it will start a conversation. You know, all these composite indexes like this, none is perfect. You know, there are lots of things that are important to human development and human well-being that aren't captured in this index. But what we hope is that it will start a conversation about why different groups of Americans are doing better than others, why some are lagging behind, and what we as a country can really do to give everybody a fair shot at a life of opportunity and choice and freedom.
And again, I was speaking with Kristen Lewis, who works for the American Human Development Project, who just released the Measure of America, the first American Human Development Report. Thank you so much for joining us on KBOO.
Thanks for having me, Gabby.
Good evening again. You're still listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, to our weekly Women's News and Public Affairs program, Bread and Roses. And if you're interested in this document, this book, that really has an amazing variety and amount of data in it, it's called The First American Human Development Report. It is released by the American Human Development Project. You could probably Google that, but also it's you can go on www.measureofamerica.org, and it's available apparently on Amazon, and it's reasonably priced. So we will go from the more broader to the more local level, and I want to introduce my second guest. Are you there?
Yes.
Jean DeMaster.
Yes.
Good evening. Thank
Hello.
You for taking the time off on this
Thank
incredibly
you for
inviting hot Friday
me.
Evening. Jean DeMaster is the Director of Human Solutions, which is a local social service agency. You want to explain a little bit more what Human Solutions is?
Right. Human Solutions is a nonprofit agency that serves homeless and low-income people in Mid and East Multnomah County. So we serve the area from 82nd Street East all the way to the Hood River County line, and from the Columbia River south to the Clackamas County line. It's an area of about 245 square miles in Mid and East Multnomah County.
And when we exchanged emails, and you pointed out to me that your demographics in that area look quite different than the rest of Multnomah County, which, of course, is a reflection of what the Human Development Report demonstrates. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Right. We're seeing the same kind of thing as the Human Development Report. Is if you look at Multnomah County as a whole, you might think we're doing pretty well and we're pretty healthy here in Multnomah County. But when you look at the specifics of East Multnomah County, particularly the Rockwood area, the area between about 140 148th Street and 102nd Street between Halsey and Division, that area right there of Multnomah County. If you look at that, the number of people in poverty in that area is 19%. If you look at Multnomah County for a whole, it's 12%. So we have a much higher percentage of people in poverty. And the disparity is much greater if you look at children. In this area of Rockwood, the number of children, children under the age of 17 that are living in poverty is 41% in Rockwood and only 28% in Multnomah County. So a much higher percentage of the children are living in poverty, and it relates back to the disparity in education and then later in income that your previous speaker was talking about. We can look at the same kinds of figures for per capita income or for unemployment. They are much higher in this area of Rockwood and East Multnomah County than they are for Portland as a whole, Gresham as a whole, or the county as a whole.
And at the same time, there are less resources.
There are less resources. The schools in this area, David Douglas, Park Rose, Gresham Barlow, are very fine schools, but they are overcrowded. They are very full in contrast to Portland Public Schools that often have vacancies or declining enrollment. So the schools are good, but they're overcrowded. And many of the schools have more than one language spoken in the school. So by the children coming to school, in fact, some schools in the Reynolds School District will have children coming that speak more than 20 different languages. Even in one classroom, the children come from 20 different languages spoken at home, and it makes it much more difficult to teach those children.
And the Human Development Report, the national one, talks about the connection between obesity and poverty. And then back to the local level, it's interesting to me that this area that you mentioned not only has low income but also has less resources in terms of grocery stores.
It has less resources. The regional equity access, that is the metropolitan area's kind of map for geography and all of these, the same kind of information that the national study shows that there's much less access to food in this East County area, fewer grocery stores and more fast food restaurants, and shows that there are more children that walk less. In fact, there are less sidewalks in this area. It's not a safe area. There are fewer parks in this area. So children walk less, and the rate of obesity in lower income neighborhoods is much higher.
And I think sometimes people who are not familiar with this issue kind of dismiss poor people who are obviously overweight, because they assume, you know, I don't know what they assume, but they assume they draw the wrong conclusion not knowing this information.
I think people assume that anybody can control their weight who wants to, and I think that's not a correct assumption. And part of why people can't control it is if you only have access to fast foods, if you don't have access, for example, if you're a homeless family and you don't have access to a refrigerator, then and you can't store your food, you end up eating a lot more fast foods and high fat foods than somebody who can store fresh vegetables and can keep milk in a refrigerator. The percentage of very low income families and homeless families in this area of our county is much higher than in other areas.
And again, I'm speaking with Gina Master, the director of Human Solutions, who works in East Multnomah County, Mid and East Multnomah County. So what kind of programs does your agency have to address some of these issues?
One set of programs that we have are shelters. We have shelters and housing programs for homeless families. So our programs help families get in off the streets, particularly families that are living in their cars, living in campgrounds, living in abandoned buildings, or are doubled up in dangerous situations. We help those families get into shelters or get into housing so they can reestablish their lives. In particular, most parents want to be able to work and be self-sufficient and support their families, but they can't go to work if they don't have any house to live in and to be in and to get ready for work from. So we try and help families get into housing and then become stable. Another one of our programs is that we do employment training. And so one of our employment training programs provides training, but it does that by organizing a clothing store. So we solicit donations of clothing from the public, and then the people in the employment training program organize those clothes and put them out like a store, and then low-income people come and can get the clothing for free. So it means that the low-income people can get free clothing, and then the money that they would have spent on clothes, they can save for food or rent, and our clients get employment training. But our donations of clothing are way down, and our donations to the shelter are way down, I think because our economy in Oregon, in Multnomah County, in this country, is tightening up, and people don't have as much that they can give away to charities like Human Solutions.
And actually, the store, as you call it, is the way I found you, because I got I work with homeless students in a public school district, and
yes.
I needed shoes, and I got them at the store for free for my students. So it is. I was not aware that there is such a place. It's in the Gateway area. It's a store, except there's no money exchanged.
Right. We're on 99th and Northeast Gleason, and we get donations. The shoes, some of the shoes came from Nike. Some of the shoes come from Fred Meyer. Some of the shoes come from the Portland Trailblazers. We get lots of donations, but we have more than 29,000 visits have been made to the store in just this year. And so we need lots and lots of clothing to be able to give out to people and to have enough shoes and have enough clothing, especially now as school is starting for kids.
And I want to play the devil's advocate for a second here. You are on cable, which is a radio station left of the dial, of course, and I believe there are some listeners out there that may be thinking that charity or social services are not the solution to the problems we face in terms of inequality in the United States, that there has to be a political response, there has to be a revolution or whatever. And I tend to agree with that. However, meanwhile, there are a lot of people out there who are quite desperate. And what you just said about school starting, I'm not officially back to work yet. I'm half the summer's off when school is not in session. But I'm also getting flooded with calls already by families who would love their children to start school in September, but they just don't have clothes and school supplies to measure up with the rest of the kids. So revolution is nice, and hopefully we have one someday. But meanwhile, I think we got to deal with our neighbors.
I mean, I would agree with you that the distribution of wealth in our country is not right, and this problem could be solved by a better distribution of wealth and fewer dollars going toward war and more dollars going toward helping people here. That's a change that needs to be made on a federal level, and we can look for that change in terms of how we vote in the next election. But if you're looking outside tonight, there are people who are homeless that are outside tonight. There are families who are outside tonight. Some are in domestic violence situations. Some are in cars. Some are in campgrounds. And for those families, they need help right now. For the school-age kids that you're talking about that are getting ready to go back to school in just a couple of weeks, those children need clothes to go to school in, and they need school supplies to be able to participate with their classmates. And those things can't wait for a revolution. And those children can't wait till we change the system. They need our help right now to be able to become productive citizens and not stay as low-income people.
So if somebody were to donate to you, how would I do that? And what are the items you most urgently need right now?
In terms of the Helping Hands Community Store, the items we need most are any kind of clothing, everything from that kids could wear to school. So any kind of pants or shirts, but we also need underwear. People oftentimes don't think of underwear, and yet it's expensive for low-income people to buy. Underwear, we need clothing. In just a few weeks, it's going to start getting cold, so we need jackets. We also need support for our shelter, and that comes from people wanting to volunteer, or it comes from people wanting to make donations. If people want to donate to the clothing store, the Helping Hand store, they can just bring that clothing or any donation that they want to the store. And again, we're on 99th and Northeast Gleason, right near the Gateway Fred Meyer area. And we're available to take the donations from 10 o'clock till 2 o'clock. And we'll take the donations and then we'll organize it in the store and we'll give it out to people that are in need.
And other ways to get in touch with you or look your programs up.
If you want to look at Human Solutions, the best way is to probably to go on the web, and we're at www.humansolutions.org. And Human Solutions is all one word. But you can go there and find all the different programs that we offer, from the shelter programs to the employment programs to rent assistance to energy assistance, all kinds of programs to make families and individuals be self-sufficient and not have to live in poverty anymore. Longer.
And thank you so much for coming on this Friday night. Again, this is Jean DeMaster, the Director of Human Solutions. And if you missed any of the information, call the station, leave your number, and I will call you back.
Thank you for your invitation.
All right. Thank you so much. And I will go out with this Olympic music, if you will. My name is Gavi. My engineer was Chris. And I had, as guest, I had Chris from the Measure for America, the first American Human Development Report, which I just learned is available at Powell's for about a week's worth of supply of lattes. For that amount of money, you can get it at Powell's. Or you get it online at www.measureofamericaoneword.org. And the our second guest, Jean DeMaster, the Director of Human Solutions, the Helping Hands Community Store, again, is at 999 Northeast Gleason. It's walking distance from the Gateway Transit Center. They are very grateful to get any kind of clothing, particularly now children's clothing. And, you know, of course, they'd like it to be clean and in good condition, plus things like socks and underwear and, of course, it'd be good if those were new. So thank you for listening and thank you for caring, and take care of each other out there and stay cool. Good evening.
You've been listening to a archived Bread and Roses program from this summer by Gabby, as you've heard, and I am your host, Jen Lavender, and want to encourage you to tune in every week for Bread and Roses Feminist News and Public Affairs from 6 to 7 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Some other programming that you might be interested in that's up and coming is the International Women's Day. Sunday, March 8th at 6 a.m. will be a day of programming produced by and about women to mark International Women's Day. And you can check out KBOO.FM for more information about the programming for that day. And every Monday at 6 p.m. is Labor Radio, which has important reports about local labor struggles, which there are many of. And so Monday at 6 is Labor Radio, and you can tune in for that. We're going to take a short music break, and then we'll go out with some announcements.